Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dangerous Dames. I am Courtney Turner. I'm the host of the Courtney Turner podcast. And with me, joining me, is my very dangerous co-host, Dr. Lee Merritt. She is known as the medical rebel. She was once an orthopedic surgeon, and now she is a medical rebel who speaks dangerous truths. And that is what we're here to do. We're here to share with you the dangerous truths. And before we can bring her on, but let's go through some of our sponsors and thank them so much. We have the rncstore.com, and the code is dangerous for that. And so this is where you can get all your products with B17. And I just spoke to them. They are in the works on getting some great stuff. Like, they're going to add the bars back. They have some other really great products that they're in the works on creating for children. Of course, I think adults will probably enjoy them as well. So they're working on that. And then we also have the Brave TV.store. And of course, code there is dangerous as well. So, well, how are you doing today?
Hey, thanks. I accidentally hit the wrong button and knocked myself out.
I was wondering where you went.
What was going on? It's a good.
Yeah. So bravetv.store/dangerous, or just go to bravetv.store and the code is dangerous to get your discounts there. So, yeah. So I thought today I would talk a little bit about, I've been going back and forth to the state capitol, and this has been a very illuminating experience for me. I would like to say that whatever hope and faith I had in our political system has been completely eviscerated. So that's been my experience. These people are, I was prepared for the corruption, but these people are just not nearly as informed as you would hope for people who are supposed to be representing us. So the two issues that I've been really battling are this land grab that we talked about, the natural asset companies. And then the other one is this school choice narrative. And I'm going to call it a narrative because it's not school choice. It's government school choice. And their initiative is really to take control of the homeschoolers. That's really their goal. So I've been back and forth trying to explain that, you know, I really don't care what verbiage, because this, I think, is the ploy. They tell you, oh, we have a caption bill, but we don't have the actual wording. We just have a caption bill. And what I keep telling them is I don't really care about the wording. I reject the whole bill. I want to kill the bill altogether. There is no wording that you're going to present to me that is going to satisfy me, because I reject the premise behind this bill. And it is I highly recommend the work of Charlotte Isherbit. She was a whistleblower under the Reagan administration, and she wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. And her father and her grandfather were both Skull and Bones. And so she had access to, right. So she had access to the Little Black Book. And she was in touch with Anthony Sutton, who wrote this book. I mean, he's written many things. When he was doing the research, they were in touch. And he was trying to find more information. And so she actually gave him the Little Black Book that helped him to write this book. And the whole middle chapter is all about how the order controls education. And Charlotte had a lot of documents, like the Carnegie Foundation documents that we're talking about. Like, one of them was called Conclusions and Recommendations. I have no idea why they called it that, but they come up with weird names that have nothing to do with what they're actually doing.
They don't need to have any of these meetings and all these. They could just do it. The elite can just control this stuff directly, but they have to make the little people feel like they're making their decision. This is the, you know, what's it called? It's I'm blanking on the name, starts with a D. It's a process where you make the people on the board feel like they are actually the ones making the decision, when it's really being run by the executive director. And that's out of Tavistock. And I'm sure you know what the word is. I can't think of it right now. But anyway, that's what they can do. So I know that they are, what you said, so all this part, how they do it, in this, all these meetings, like you said, what's the name mean? I'm just saying it doesn't need to mean anything, because it makes them, it's just for us little people. So we feel like we're involved in something very cool and we're going to help the world and we're going to make education better. And then they run it into the ground like they plan to do, because at the end of the day, they really don't want us to be here. They want to dumb us down to make us slaves and kill the people they can't dumb down. And once we realize that, then we'll get the picture here. But go ahead.
That's absolutely right. So I actually just did a podcast with my friend Peter Duke, and he wrote this book, which is interesting, called The Stealth Power and Illusion of Democracy. And what he did, are you familiar with it?
No, I haven't read the book, but I'm familiar with
the title. Yeah. but what he did was actually very interesting. He took the protocols of the Elders of Zion and he took out the cultural references. So not applying it to any specific group of people, he kind of renamed, you know, so wherever it would say Freemasons, he would just call it secret society, or wherever, you know, if it was, you know, talking about like Zion or Zionist, you know, he just said like the power elite. So he takes that out so that you're kind of removed from, you know, the what could be kind of polarizing aspects of it. And he used AI to like kind of simplify the translations. And it's a very interesting. And of course, he has his own kind of like assessment in the beginning. And then he has the conclusion, which was all about Lord Northcliffe. And, you know, he brought up Tavistock, like Lord Northcliffe was one of the, forerunners of the British Propaganda Bureau that became Tavistock. And it's interesting, once he started asking questions, they declared him mad and they basically suicided him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But what I thought was interesting, the reason I brought it up was because when you were talking about how they have these meetings and the whole political system, like of us being allowed to come into, you know, these meetings that we pay their salary through taxes, right? And they act like, oh, we'll let you in here, you know, and we'll let you feel like you're a part of the system. So apparently that's principle three, which is it's translated as methods of conquest. And they, you know, this is AI language, and it's obviously not in the original, but it says that because he changed it to principles from protocols. And he said that was Reed who turned him on to an author who turned him on to even doing this project after reading his book. But he called them principles, not protocols. He thought that was more accurate. But number three says, we've trapped the masses in poverty in a more binding chain than slavery or serfdom. The so-called people's rights included in the Constitution are merely illusory, offering no real benefit to the laboring proletariat who remains subject to our whims. And then it goes on to say essentially that this whole like idea of us, having our self-governance is really just so that we don't rebel and revolt, because
the illusion of control over our lives.
Yeah.
It's like the cows that don't see the fences. Fences are far enough out there. They don't see the fences. That's my.
Exactly. So I've started to kind of do some diving into the origins of this school choice narrative. And Iserbit talks about how in these documents of the Carnegie Foundation, that it's all tied to Common Core, and that in their document, they actually say the goal is to put every child into a computer. And we know back then they said it was to create to train them instead of educate them so that they're part of a global workforce. And of course, you know, now that language has been transferred to global citizen, but it's still about creating a global workforce
it's a global slavery system.
Yes.
That they want, you know, they don't want thinkers. They want slaves.
They want slaves. And I'm just going to read this too, because this was interesting. What?
Because I'm not going to sugarcoat anything they're doing anymore.
No, I appreciate that. You say it exactly like it is. Yeah.
I will translate it into street talk. Okay, go ahead.
No, we need to just call it out. But this was really interesting. So she starts off her book, Charlotte Iserbit, and I recommend that anybody who's going to get this book, get the original unabridged. So there's an abridged version, which I know people love because nobody likes to read anymore. however, you can see how thick this book is. And this is a used copy because I was having a hard time finding the original, copy. But the second half of it is just the appendix, and she's got like three appendixes and glossaries, which are all very helpful. So I do recommend, if you're going to get it, you know, any copy is better than none, but she's just like a gold mine. She's a wealth of information. But in, she starts out her book and she talks about the changing of the definition of education. And I thought this was so profound because it shows how they took, you know, the origins of education, which was really to create aristocratic man. Yeah. And I don't mean that in terms of like, we think of it as like, you know, aristocrats in the bloodlines, but that's actually not what it meant in ancient Greece. In ancient Greece, it was, you know, somebody who had been educated and who, you know, had a certain pedigree, essentially. Now, of course, if you're part of a certain class, you might be more.
Right. I was going to say, I'm not sure it wasn't the bloodlines back then. They just, again, they know how to say it in such a way that we don't respond and act.
Yeah, I actually think
again, how many people in Harvard are not, you know, or some of these.
That's true. But I actually don't think back then that's what the Greeks meant by aristocratic man, because I think, and this is just my theory, but I think that there's kind of been a psyop in the interpretation of Plato and Aristotle, and it's been designed to create this left-right dialectic, where, you know, they've kind of created a narrative around Aristotle being the conservative and he's kind of the ideal figure for the political right, and that Plato was the father of, the Republic and the father of communism. And I don't think that that's 100% true. I actually think it's a lot more nuanced than that. If you look at it philosophically, I think that there's good and bad elements of both of them. I actually agree with a lot of things in both of them, and I disagree with a lot in both of them.
Right, but how does that relate to whether this education back then was really just for the elites?
I'll tell you,
because you don't see, you know, did they have, when you look at their students, we always hear of other famous names, you know, that we know.
Right, but this is my theory. So my theory is that Plato was actually trying to create an academy, right, which was more of a meritocracy, but he had to work within code because they were the same type of ruling, quote unquote, elites back then. And back then, they were descendants of the mystery schools, but it's the same kind of occult groups that were running the show through, yes, bloodlines and also dark occultural ritualistic initiation. And those were the groups that were in charge and running things. And so when he was creating this, he had to speak in code because otherwise they would not approve of what he was doing. And this is just my interpretation. I am going to do a dive where I can reread more Plato to see. But I think that he was trying to create a potential education for people that was based on a meritocratic system where, you know, if you had the trivium and then you went on to the quadrivium, that you had the foundations to actually be educated and you could enter into a aristocratic man without having been part of a bloodline or taking or doing the ritualized initiation. I don't know. I mean, I think it's very plausible though. When you look at what he was doing and when you look at his style of writing, and he was very comedic. He did a lot of his writing is done through the words of Socrates, who was kind of, he tried to make all of his points through mockery. Like he would present the most absurd kind of a case to prove his point. So I think, I don't know, that is my theory on that. But this narrative that Aristotle was, you know, the great figurehead and the man that the political right should worship, and that Plato is, you know, demonized by the right, I think it's a little bit, it seems contrived when you really look at them philosophically. I like elements of both. I dislike elements of both, but Aristotle was actually much more materialistic in his metaphysics. It was very much rooted. There is nothing in there that indicates that he believes in some sort of a creator, some sort of a, you know, higher power, everything. I love what he did with virtues and, you know, some of his thoughts were great, but it was all in the, you know, very physical domain. That was his metaphysical paradigm. Whereas Plato was kind of the opposite. You know, he very much saw that there was, you know, if you read his work, he very much alludes to there being a creator, somebody, a higher power, that a lot of the forms that we have here on Earth are by design and that there is a higher intelligence. So anyway, all that to say, I do think that, yeah, that's a bit of a side note. But with these two definitions, the reason why I thought they were really profound is because it shows how not only did they change the definition in order to control man, but also they're paving the way for the transhuman man. And the original definition is that she puts forth is in 1927. She says the drawing out of a person's innate talents and abilities by imparting the knowledge of languages, scientific reasoning, history, literature, rhetoric, etc. So, of course, rhetoric was part of the original trivium, you know, rhetoric, logic, grammar, which we are not taught these days. The Common Core right. was all about eviscerating the channels which through which those abilities would flourish and serve. And then it's less than a decade later, in 1934, Barnes & Noble's definition changed it to learning is a result of the modifiability in the paths of neural connection. Explanations of even such forms of learning as abstraction and generalization demand the neuron's only growth, excitability, conductivity, modifiability. The mind is the connection system of man, and learning is the process of connecting. The situation response formula is it adequate to cover any learning of any sort? And really influential factors in learning are readiness of the neurons, sequence in time, belongingness, and satisfying consequences.
Okay, so what's the point in all that? That that you're saying that paves the way for this idea that they're going to improve the physical structure of the brain to...
Well, it indicates how when they talk about how they want to put when they want to put every child into a computer, that they're really, and when you, this is another great resource, is a School World Order, the technocratic globalization of corporatized education. And that is really their goal. And this is what she illustrates like decades ago. And it's also what, and we'll talk about Skull and Bones, what Wundt, who really was through the Leipzig connection, he was kind of the progenitor of this whole Americanization of the Prussian model of education. So my point in showing those two definitions is just that I think that they're trying to create a global citizen who will be transhuman. Because when they talk, the first definition of education was about giving you the tools in order to harness your own talents, your own passions, and, you know, so you could flourish into the best version of yourself. That's what education was designed to do. That is, I think, the definition of education. Second definition talks about you as being like biomechanical robots, essentially, that education is nothing more than the activity of the neurological activity of the brain, which I don't think is true. I mean, I think there's education is a lot more than just neurological activity. So, but that's kind of the contrast between those two.
But, okay, I guess, you know, I'll believe that this is all, you know, they're making it sound like this is a good thing, that we're going to educate the masses, and we're going to improve education by doing all these things. But in the end, they never do it themselves. When Elon Musk gets a brain chip, then I might believe this is really something he believes in. But you know he won't. It's like you saw the kids of who was the Apple founder,
Steve Jobs.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. His kids didn't have computers. You know, his
cell
phone. Now, why is that? See, that's what they've done.
Kids don't have social media.
I would argue that's been done since time immemorial. I don't know for sure with Plato and Aristotle, but you know, you go back but just in general, I think that they wouldn't have had slave rebellions if it weren't there. There's a different class of citizen that is available to these things, and they have to make sure the real people on top make sure that classes of citizens like us, like our kids and people and I don't mean that in the wrong way, but just people that they go after education. They're a threat to their, you know how they always say we're a threat to democracy. Mm-hmm. We are a threat to their mob rule. And those are the ones that they're trying to hook into what you're talking about. I think it's to make sure that we don't have any of these stupid slaves getting too educated correctly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
To bring other people out.
No, I 100% agree. That's exactly right. So they're talking about now, so they've taken the original definition, which was to give people, I mean, the trivium, and we'll just to simplify it, the trivium was rhetoric, logic, and grammar. That was, those were tools, the quadrivium added geometry, but these were just foundational tools that gave, you know, children and adults the building blocks to be able to learn and to be able to have critical thinking. What they want to do is eradicate any critical thinking. And this comes out of this where, you know, the this is where the Skull and Bones work is comes into play under Wundt, Wilhelm Wundt. But this starts with the Battle of Jena in 1806, and they lost the Battle of Jena. This was in the Napoleonic Wars. Right. So Wilhelm Wundt was very, very heavily influenced by Hegel. And this is
we're going to get to the Skull and Bones, right?
Yes. Wilhelm Wundt was very instrumental in Skull and Bones. And he was very influenced by Hegel. And this is interesting. I did find out that Hegel apparently met Napoleon and like worshipped him. He thought he was just like, not really a surprise. And I did do some digging. So I think I told you, like, I had a theory that Hegel was a member of the Illuminati. He himself was not. I can't find any direct evidence that he was, but he was very influenced by people who were, like John Gottlieb Fichte and Goethe, who wrote Faust. He was, they were members. They were definitely members of the Illuminati, and I can find their names because everybody had a code name in the Illuminati. But just to give you a little sense of what Fichte believed, he wrote the book, The Vocation of Man, and he said, education should aim at destroying free will so that after pupils have left school, they shall be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than their schoolmasters would have wished.
But
So this is the influence. Yeah. This is the influence on Hegel. And Hegel then in turn influenced Wilhelm Wundt. And Wilhelm Wundt was he was out of Germany. He taught out of this Leipzig University in Germany. And there's a great book on this. It's called The Leipzig Connection. It's a short one. It's like 155 pages or something by Klass and Leone. And they talk about the entire, so I can name, this is where we get, again, that definition becomes so relevant because they really talk about the, essentially like the Skinnerian model of education. So it's no longer about giving children the tools to become critical thinkers. It's about Pavlovian responses. And Wundt taught people like Pavlov was one of his students in Leipzig, Germany. G. Stanley Hall, who became a mentor to John Dewey. John Dewey is, of course, famous for exporting this Prussian model of education to the United States. And when they created the Prussian model in after the Napoleonic Wars, it was because they lost the Battle of Jena. And they said that it was because the soldiers rebelled because they were critical thinkers. And so the literal translation was we have to design a model of education where we eradicate critical thinking and we breed mindless, obedient soldiers. And right. So that, again, this is where like Hegel becomes relevant. And I just want to read this part that Sutton says in the beginning, just for people to have a framework when they're understanding this. He says that above all, the reader, at least temporarily while reading this work, must put to one side the descriptive cliches of left and right, liberal and conservative, communist and fascist, even Republican and Democrat. These terms may be important for self-recognition. They do provide a certain reassurance, but they are confusing in our context unless seen as essential elements in a game plan. You'll never understand the order if you try to label it left and right. And this is why. Because the order uses the Hegelian dialectic process to bring about a society in which the state is absolute, all powerful. Mm-hmm. And there's the left Hegelians and the right Hegelians. And the order uses this to manipulate the masses. So the left Hegelians are, you know, pretty famous. It's people like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, right? And they were advancing a scientific progression. And then the right Hegelians were instrumental in Prussian militarism, the rise of Nazism. And this is very relevant to education. These are some of the Prussian right Hegelians. And this is very instrumental when you think about our current education model, because this is where we get like that, you know, the very sharp time slots, ringing the bell, you know, it's very militarized. And this is to drill obedience and compliance. And of course, you know, they're masters. Yeah.
But I just want to say this left and right separation is totally artificial because everybody there are statists.
That was the whole point.
Right. The point. Yeah. Let's just to be clear. I hate that term left and right. And I know you do too for that reason. It is an artificial thing that they've derived because they really want us to believe that these are, you know, two different groups and that, you know, somehow the Nazis were different than the Marxists and they were all statists. Okay.
Oh, yes. And this is Hegel. Hegel believed the state equal God. So all of them. Yes, this is absolutely correct. That's why to put aside the left and right. It's just important to understand like the people who aligned, because I always say that I actually think those labels are they're target audiences for marketing. Because, and this is where it becomes very relevant for things like school choice, because, you know, people who identify as being on the right or like right-wing Republican, they love the idea of freedom, choice. So these become great marketing buzzwords. So they'll say, okay, well, now we're going to, you know, create this whole school choice platform. We already have choice. You know, parents have the right to homeschool their children, put them in private school, put them in parochial school, put them in public school. They have choice. But what they want to advocate for through this legislation is government school choice. So it's a totally like, you know, misleading label.
You know, when that started, I was a homeschooler when that whole thing started, or at least when I became aware of it. And that was because it's that the people that can afford private education have choice, but the people that can't are stuck in these lousy inner city schools. So what it was to do is to refund their tax, is to refund federal funds, the tax funds that everybody's paying for this, to the people that don't use it, which I don't have a problem with that. But unfortunately, again, they're going to control us through money. So it's not the ultimate answer. The ultimate answer is just get rid of public schools. And people are not going to like that idea, but I'm just going to say, how have they helped our society?
They have not. You know,
my grandfather was dirt poor. I mean, I'm not kidding, dirt poor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now this is in the outhouse days and in the, you know, late 1800s. But, you know, he was much more educated than and only had to the eighth grade, you know, one room schoolhouse. And that's not a myth. That really happened. And public education ruined that. And gave us, instead of a group of thinkers, they gave us a bunch of, you know, you're right. It was the Prussian school
model of education. Yeah.
I'm sitting here though thinking, now, when it comes to Skull and Bones, what's all the symbolism? We have these secret societies in education. They're within the universities and they're there theoretically because they're supposed to be some kind of elite educational group. Purportedly, I would, but they're not. They have what's the real reason you think we have? I mean, I kind of know, but does it have anything really to do with education?
It has nothing to do with education. It has everything to do with control. It's really interesting because the other issue I'm like working on is this whole land grab, the NACs, and I thought for sure they're not related, right? Other than the elites the parasite class trying to, you know, create their neo-feudal system. Other than that, I didn't really think they were directly related. However, lo and behold, it was the Order of Skull and Bones that was instrumental in creating the Morrill Land Act, which President Lincoln signed. And this was back in the 1800s. And this was a whole plan of the Anglo-British the Anglo-American establishment to try and steal the land. They created, and they did all under the guise of conservation. And they were that's why in the western states of the United States, they have all of this conserved land that comes out of the Morrill Land
Act. Morrill Land Act. OK.
Yes. And this was the Order of Skull and Bones that did it.
Morrill, not Morrill.
No, Morrill. Sorry. It wasn't very moral.
I thought that would be a great name. They'd name that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Save the whales, kill the whales, you know.
Yeah, I didn't think it was all that immoral. Morrill and of 1862. And it was the Order of Skull and Bones that did this in order to give a bunch of land grants to both Yale University and Cornell. They did. They implemented it in both. Exactly. So it's to create these umbrellas so that they can, you know, push through their different agenda. And they do it. I think the reason they do a lot of this through secret societies in academia is because they're creating a whole new crop of indoctrinated, what do you call them? Like disciples. And that, so you think about like that whole chain, right? You've got the Hegelians who come out of Fichte and Goethe, which essentially is coming out of the Illuminati. And he draws, and it's very interesting, if anybody were to have a, like, be able to get a hold of Sutton's, like, works that didn't get published, I think it would be very fascinating, because throughout this whole book, he talks about how there needs to be some further education, some further research done to draw the connection between Skull and Bones and the Illuminati. And there are several connections, and he outlines some of them here. But he says the next book will outline that, but he never did write that next book. So I don't know if he was working on it before he died, but Wundt directly had a connection to the Illuminati. His grandfather was Kirchenrat Karl Casimir Wundt, and his name was Raphael in the Illuminati.
Did Sutton understand the bloodline, the physical, relative, everybody's a relative of everybody, that it's all a big family that's doing this?
Yeah, and he goes through the family trees of a bunch of these people, like who is it, Daniel Coit Gilman, and he goes through like most of his family were in the Order of Skull and Bones, and then he was appointed to be the one to create the initial Russell Trust. So the Russell Trust, William Russell was the founder, along with Alfonso Taft. Taft was one of our related to our president Taft. So our one of our very earliest presidents was a direct founder of Skull and Bones, was related to the founder of Skull and Bones. But he draws this whole, and he created the Russell Trust. In the Russell Trust, there's nothing about Skull and Bones. We know that it was William Russell who was, one of the founders. And then he goes through this whole tree with the different, all the different, not just the families, but then also the different universities. So I think they're intertwined, because they use the universities as an umbrella to, one, indoctrinate, but then also to control. It's a way.
See, that's what I guess that's what I was getting at. So I don't see the Skull and Bones or these secret societies that we hear about. You know, the Scroll and Key being a bigger money group than the Skull and Bones at Yale. But they don't. And then there's the Wolf's Head, too. There's three secret societies at Yale.
He talks about that.
So I never looked at them as they were trying to get. Yeah, there's my favorite Scroll and Key Society member. What I always looked at is this is an ancient family bloodline, mm-hmm. and they took off their crowns and their pharaoh's hats and they became kings, mm-hmm. and then they took the kings off when that wasn't cool, and they became bankers for the most part, and mm-hmm. then as they moved through the world, they had to give their people a backstory. Essentially, you just can't stick your kid into, as they tried to with the kids of Biden and Pelosi and those guys into Burisma. You just can't stick your kid into big business because he's your kid. We got to give him a backstory. So we send them to Yale. We send them to Harvard Law School, mm-hmm. etc. Yep. And it's just kind of a rite of passage for these guys to then become our leaders, because it's kind of like it's the Illuminati equivalent of your football players, that they go to college because they're the greatest running back in high school, and they don't really care if they take calculus or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's not about their education. It's about other things. But they come out with a certificate and the imprimatur of something.
Yes, but it's not only that. It really is the indoctrination, because if you look at all of these key figures, they all share this worldview that the state is all powerful and that we can only achieve freedom through subservience to the state.
Right. And but if you believe, If you believe, as I do, that these children are tortured from the time they're in, sexually tortured, the children of the Illuminati that we're talking about here, they grew up in these bloodlines that believe in torturing their children from birth to age six. And there's just a story came out earlier about, about the, even in the womb, they're about, you know, Bush and Kerry being, you know, like having to service 100 men each in to be in the Skull and Bones, something like that. I mean, I kind of think that they are already in, they're just, it's just more of the same. I, maybe I'm wrong, but go ahead. I didn't interrupt you.
I do think, I think that that's right. But then in order to convince the masses that there's some legitimacy, they have to have, they have to have all of this, you know, academic theory. And that's really what they've, that's what they promulgate. And then you have all of
you mean what we call psychobabble.
Yes.
A lot of this is psychobabble. I mean, that's what we used to call it when it just does, you know, it doesn't play out in the real world, but it sure sounds good in academia.
It sounds great in academia.
You know, and some of it might play out in the real world. I don't know. You know, I don't,
I think the whole field of social science was created basically to, I mean, I think they thought they were a wizard. They thought they could implement mind control through, they wanted to create a, you know, secular, which weren't really secular, but like occult solutions, esoteric solutions to, you know, spiritual problems. And it really does, I think, start with Wundt, because Wundt was the one who took it from this, you know, he kind of created the field of psychology. He's known as the father of psychology. And then one of his students was William James, and he was the American father of psychology. And, you know, he gave it a lot of legitimacy because he gave the first PhDs, and he, I mean, it was hundreds who, and really it, by an extension of Wundt, it was thousands of people received PhDs in psychology, and not just psychology, but as an extension of his Leipzig connection, Leipzig University. And that it did create legitimacy, I think, for the field, because they claimed that it was all very scientific. This is why it's like the Pavlovian, the Skinnerian model, that they can conduct all these controlled scientific experiments. But really, it was, when you look at people like Freud and Jung, it is a lot of psychobabble. I mean, it is a lot of mysticism.
Right. And I was going to say, it's either psychobabble, or it is a very, what I would say, a very contrived series of articles and theories to support a pedophile overlord structure. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what Freud did. And then look at Kinsey. I mean, no matter where you look, at the top of psych, even I got to say Skinner to a certain degree. I mean, the idea of putting a baby in a box, and, you know, kind of this, you know,
it's so warped.
Yeah.
It's not, so inhumane. Yeah. Because they were treating them like lab rats. Absolutely. So they talk about, he talks about how the order basically created the constitution for UNESCO. So of course UNESCO is behind education, but I thought you would find this part interesting, because he says, that they were trying to, he says, okay, for the moment, we want to know the impetus for reorganizing medical education in the United States came from John D. Rockefeller, right? But the funds were channeled through a single member of the order. Briefly, the story is this. One day in 1912, Frederick Gates of Rockefeller Foundation had lunch with Abraham Flexner of the Carnegie Institution. He says to Gates, Gates says to Flexner, "What would you do if you had $1 million with which to make a start in reorganizing medical education to the United States?" And as reported by Fosdick, this is what happened. The bluntness was characteristic of Mr. Gates, but the question about the $1 million was hardly in accord with his usual indirect and cautious approach to the spending of money. Flexner's reply, however, to the effect that any funds, $1 million or otherwise, could most profitably be spent in developing the Johns Hopkins Medical School. And of course, we've seen, you know, Johns Hopkins, that's where Operation Lockstep comes from, that Hopkins document. Right,
and a lot of other things.
You know,
that's just, where, look at who helped sponsor Event 201.
Exactly.
And Johns Hopkins was Frederick Gates, that you just alluded to. It was his son, Frederick Gates, the son Gates, who developed and or took took the vaccines to start the pandemic of 1918 from the Rockefeller Institute that he got. So, and he was trained in medical school at Johns Hopkins. I just have to say there's a triad of, not to say that this is that the institutions are all bad or that they're all the students who are involved in this. I don't ever mean to say that, but there is a triad of where they put their kids. It's Harvard, Yale, and Johns Hopkins with a little bit of Stanford. You know, that just seems to be the big three, Harvard, Yale, and Johns Hopkins.
Yep, it does. And I don't think that's a coincidence. That's very, very pointed. It says it struck a responsive chord in Gates, who was already a close friend and devoted admirer of Dr. William H. Welch, the dean of the institution. Welch was president of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research from 1901 and a trustee of the Carnegie Institution from 1906. Welch was also a member of the order and had been brought to Johns Hopkins University by the guy who created the initial trust, the Russell Trust, Daniel Coit Gilman. He goes on. But yeah, so the connections, I mean, yeah, we could go through all of them, but it's a pretty, he does a pretty extensive study. Yeah, those are the trio who pretty much started like the order. But yeah, it's all through. Cornell seemed very involved too. But I don't know if Cornell is less involved these days. I'm not sure. But the Cornell was part of that Morrill Land Act. They had a whole grant for Cornell University, upstate New York. I do feel like a lot of research and very suspicious kind of projects do come out of upstate New York. But I don't know.
Now, William Welch, so the William Welch you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's William Welch, the pathologist. Mm-hmm. He was a Johns Hopkins pathologist. He was also the guy at AFIP who went down and autopsied the dead in Fort Riley, Kansas during the 1918 pandemic. In other words, it's a very small club of people that are running these operations, shall we say.
Yes.
You know, we can think of them as pandemics. I've started thinking of them as operations. So
they're operations.
Whether it's a war or there's probably, you know, it really is a small, tight group that are at top of pulling the strings on whatever it is that's happening. You know, it'll be interesting to see in this whole thing with, the current pushing NATO into Ukraine. Now we've got, you know, NATO people fighting in Ukraine to poke the Russians. How many people are really running this thing? You know, we keep hearing a few names, and I'm just saying it's the same thing that we've seen, what you're describing, and they all go through these secret societies in the universities.
Yes, it's all of them, and they all connect to each other. So even if they're not in the same secret society or their state, because he talks about and Scroll and Key, and he talks about they're basically sister organizations of the Order of Skull and Bones. And it does seem like it's all in the family. So that's, you know, he kind of tries to create the tree where even if somebody themselves wasn't in the order, their kids were, or their grandfather was, and then, you know, they work for one of the schools where the board of trustees is all members.
What's 322 about, by the way, in the Skull and Bones?
Do you know that? I don't know. I'm sure it's in here somewhere.
I mean, you know, the Skull and Bones itself, I mean, they admit to being kind of a, I thought somewhere I read that they, part of their thing was to embrace, you know, death, it's like the death culture. It's kind of,
I think so.
You know, but I don't think they say that out front, but I think that is what people that know about them say something about that.
Yeah.
Well, because they have all these rituals. I know what it is. They have all these rituals about, you know, fake murdering somebody where they have to pretend to stab somebody and they have the coffins and they have all this, you know.
Yeah. I don't know what
you know, when you think about a lot of this stuff, look at the symbolism and it traces way back into antiquity. What's it say? The number 322. Okay. 322 BC.
Oh, the death of the Greek.
I missed it, but about
the death of the Greek orator
Demosthenes.
Turning point of the transformation of the ancient Athens from democracy to plutocracy. Oh, okay. That makes perfect sense.
Interesting, Yeah, and see, they call their structure the tomb.
Yeah, doubled in size in 1903 and has further. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Turning it from a democracy to a plutocracy. And because they do think that they're the ones who should rule. That it should not be a democracy. Not that, I mean, democracy is an illusion anyway, but yeah.
Well, and the new term for that really is technocracy.
Well, that's a new one. Yeah, right. Because
it's the same small group of people, but we'll call them, we're going to engineer the solutions now.
I've officially lost my probably final YouTube channel.
I'm surprised you lasted so long.
Well, I mean, it was my third channel, but it was my third one. And I think I have almost 500 videos on all my other channels. I only had like 100 on there because I almost never post. But they decided today to go back and find some old video and suspend me. So, yes, the technocracy is that they feel very confident in their power. And
that would actually be a good guy to have as Patrick Wood on our show.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, I know him. I think he's
you know him too. Okay, I've interviewed him before. Yeah. Okay,
yeah, I had him on my show too. But he would be a good one because I think he would put this in perspective about
he did so much work on Sutton and on the Trilateral Commission. Right. That he's very familiar with all.
That's
of
how he
it.
Got into the whole general mm-hmm. picture of technocracies. He's like the world's expert on the Trilateral Commission. Well, and I also got a picture from him one time that shows a picture of Elon Musk's grandfather, and his grandfather was the president of the technocracy movement in Canada.
Oh, really?
You know, when we think about who's Elon Musk, really, besides wanting to put a brain chip in you. Right. And beaming you with all sorts of, you know, cellular radiation, EMF. He comes from a very distinguished technocracy lineage.
He does. So. Yeah. No, I think, speaking of the dialectics, I think he's kind of leading people to, it's a false kind of savior. You know, people think like
he's captured. He's been captured and he's now working for the good guys because his whole thing changed here not too long ago. Didn't you think? And that's a whole other topic, but
yeah, you think
yeah, that's the picture he gave me. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Elon's grandfather was head of the Canadian technocracy movement. Yeah. You got it.
I'm trying to find the whole section on the connections to the Illuminati because he has like the, all the specific members, but for some reason I can't.
The Illuminati or the CFR?
The Illuminati. I mean, there's definitely.
I didn't think we actually knew the Illuminati members.
Yeah, we do. The reason we know the Illuminati and the Illuminati is a real thing is. So I have a couple of books, but I don't think I can find them. There's one is Proofs of a Conspiracy. I think it's right there. Proofs of a Conspiracy was written by John Robison, and he was
in.
You have that. Okay. And George Washington used that to warn the public about the Illuminati, right?
Right.
And then there's Code of the Illuminati, which Thomas Jefferson used to warn the public. But the reason we know so much about the Illuminati, so they're definitely great
but
researchers.
We don't know the modern members. It's not like they get a card,
No.
Right?
Well, we don't. Yeah. Modern. I don't think
that's
it
what
actually
I'm saying. We know about kind of in general, the principles here and who,
right.
they, who so the founders were and people in the back that are long gone.
Yeah. So, the reason we know about them is because when they got shut and went underground. Yeah. So these are some of the people and they have their code names, but when they got shut underground, there was a guy who was carrying the papers from the Illuminati and he got killed. And so the, Bavarian police had all those papers. And so they had in there like the code names of the actual members. So, I mean, we do have information on the original Illuminati. And no, we don't necessarily have the modern day, but we have definitely the ideas and we have a lot of information about, the descendants and how the trail essentially, like this is a great book. It's Dr. Emmanuel Mann-Josephon. He's a doctor. He actually has a book on like natural solutions for glaucoma. That was one of the ways I found out about him because I was looking for alternatives to, my pharmaceutical, you know, eye drops. But he, what he does is he takes the Weishaupt's Illuminati Manifesto and Clinton Roosevelt's Science of Government Founded on Natural Law, which was written in 1841. This is, he's the cousin of President Roosevelt. And it sounds great, founded on natural law, but it's an inversion, right? They manipulate the language. And I didn't know this until actually fairly recently, but Engels was a linguist.
Mm-hmm.
Engels, yeah. So he really understood the power of language and how to manipulate it, you know, for propaganda purposes. But when basically the whole thesis is that essentially Engels, they plagiarized from the Illuminati Manifesto, Weishaupt, and Clinton Roosevelt's manifesto.
Or they didn't plagiarize it. They were given this to work with.
Yes.
Yeah, they were part of it.
And they
yeah.
were, because it yeah. was the League of the Outlaws that when the Illuminati got went underground, the League of the Outlaws became then the League of the Just. And the League right. of the Just merged with the League of the Communist League, which, you know, Marx and Engels were helming, and they were commissioned to write the Communist Manifesto. Yeah.
Right. And then the pyramid of the Illuminati that we have on our bills, and we have, you know, the yes. pyramid of the structure of this whole thing, that mm-hmm. if you just follow all the, look at the, mm-hmm. you know, the order of skull and bones is somewhere on that pyramid, because it's in that, you know, the slave class, we're all on the very bottom, but you know, and I just bought this, I don't have it yet, but I just bought one of these wall posters about the connections. It's the what's it called? It's a website that is looking to connect the dots of the deep state, and you can buy and there are various different, and people have seen it probably, the yeah, there it is. And what's the name of the website again? I should know. I'm just having a yeah, the Deep State Mapping Project. That's it. And if and they have a pyramid that shows exactly that pyramid that in the color there. They also have ones about religion and secret societies and all the different, like, so the cult of Baal. And somewhere, mm-hmm. I believe, you will find the skull and bones down there somewhere. But anyway, that's, I just got that. And so if you follow all those people, they have the Committee of 300,
yeah.
You know, the CFR, the internet, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, all of these people that we talk about. And if we put them all together there, you're looking at the Illuminati family plan right there.
Yeah.
It looks to me like that's probably what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think the actual Illuminati still exists, but when you look at like Skull and Bones, it looks like they're kind of continuing the plans of the Illuminati, and they do have direct connections. I know we put up some of those slides that had the names, and I can go through them. But before we do that, I do want to just mention this really quickly, because there was something called by Gallaudet, you know, that's the deaf university, right? So Gallaudet's two sons were both members of the Orders of Skull and Bones, and he came up with this look-say method, which was a way of teaching deaf people to read. And for the deaf, I think it was a phenomenal. Yeah. It was wonderful and very instrumental, but they have no concept of language, because, you know, I mean, some of them, I learned how to speak by reading lips. You know, there are deaf people. I wasn't completely deaf, but I was pretty significantly hearing impaired, and I did learn by reading lips. And there are some deaf people who do, but most of them don't. So they don't have a concept of language in that way. So it was kind of a pictorial representation of looking at, you know, whole units and learning to read that way, instead of something like phonics, which is the parts, and then you put them together. But when you, phonics teaches you critical thinking, because you have to figure it out by piecing things together. And it was Horace Mann who brought the look-say method to the masses. And, you know, he got rid of the traditional methods of teaching children how to read. And this is part of why Americans can't read anymore. Because
also, this is what they call whole language now.
Yes. Oh, right. Yeah.
That's the real term. The modern term is whole language. So you can learn about, it falls apart about fourth grade, because you just can't remember that many words.
Right.
You can learn to sound them out. You know them them out. And I have, you know, I've had, you know, my former stepdaughter, who's not with us anymore, but she learned I mean, she was a really smart gal, but she was growing up in that California age where she just didn't learn to, she couldn't use those the critical signs to sound out words. She didn't know what the dot over the A did to the sound of the A, for example. They never taught that. They never taught any kind of, yeah.
Mother's primer was what it came from. But yeah, wow, that's terrible.
Yeah. And there's a whole generation of people from California that you might not know it. They may be engineers and they may be doctors and they can get, they do a lot of good things, but don't ask them to read aloud. The ones that succeed, they understand what the word means, but they can't necessarily pronounce it. So they can't read aloud. I've met these people.
And that has such an impact on your processing. That's tragic.
So some people overcome it by just reading to themselves so they might pronounce the word differently, but they know they get close, but they just can't sight read like you and I could, when you just read new things that you've never read before.
Right. It's weird.
It's very weird.
It is.
That's a sidelight. That's just kind of off the topic here, I think absolutely the Illuminati is still with us. It's just that what these people do is they always change their names. The names of their gods change, the names of their organizations change, so you can't trace it. And that's why I like the Deep State Mapping Project. They've traced it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think there's a lot of evidence to indicate that the Illuminati, so Horace Mann was appointed to the president of Antioch College. And who was the board of Antioch? It was the Taps, who are the founder of Skull and Bones.
So Horace Mann was the guy that brought his whole language, essentially.
Mm-hmm. He brought the mother's primer to the masses. Yeah.
I don't know if I have one of those somewhere in the house. I mean, I've seen that book, but I just didn't realize that was the origin of this problem.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the origin. And I remember, so Horace Mann's in New York City. I had a neighbor right across the street from me who went to Horace Mann, and I almost went to Horace Mann. I didn't, but the high school. Wow. But yeah. Yeah. So some of the names who have direct ties to the Illuminati, to Skull and Bones were, who was it? It was Johann Gottfried Herder, who was known as Damascus in the Illuminati. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, who I had talked about. So he was a strong influence on Herbert. And Herbert had a very similar kind of mindset as Hegel. The state was all powerful. You know, the only purpose of education was to create subservience to the state. And so he was an influence then on Herder. And Fichte, who we talked about. Fichte also had a very early concept of creating the League of Nations. Who was the other one who was creating the League of Nations concept? Fichte and I think it was Kant, because Kant had his peaceful, like, I forgot what it was called, but his essay on like perpetual peace. And essentially, the solution was to have like a world federation that would now. Kant was much more of an idealist, whereas, of course, Fichte and Hegel are mystics. It's different. Hegel was actually a hermeticist. But yeah, so his name was Abarth in the Illuminati. And then Friedrich Schiller, who's much more well-known. He wasn't officially recorded as a member, but he was very involved in the circle. And then, of course, Goethe, who was known as Goethe was Abarth in the Illuminati. And then who did I say the other one was? Goethe. So, and then the other one was Pestalozzi. And Pestalozzi was very influential on Herbert. And Herbert influenced Wundt and Hegel. And their whole plan was for world domination and to destroy Christianity. I think it was to invert Christianity is really how I look at it. And then when you look at the university, so Illuminati was founded. I think it's a great cover, right? Because the Illuminati was founded at University of Ingolstadt. The group was founded at All Souls College, and then which was Oxford University, and then the order was founded at Yale University. So it does provide this not just cover, but great, kind of umbrella for them to be able to connect and to execute their plan. But I think what you're saying about the map is right. So I think the Skull and Bones formed as a means of being able to execute the plans of the Illuminati. And it seems like there were some direct ties. And I that's just a thesis, obviously, but it's a thesis that Sutton seemed to have as well. And I think that's what they do. I think there's lots of them, lots of these organizations, and they all have a shared worldview, and they work under these intricate umbrellas to be able to execute their plan. But what I found was just so relevant to today is how they use these false dialectics. Because when I went to go and talk to our Republican legislators, their whole mindset was, well, the Democrats are the bad guys, but we're the good guys. So essentially, we have a Republican governor, Governor Lee, who's a total globalist shill. But they believe that because he's a Republican, any of the bills that he's passing forth are good. Yeah. And that's what they keep telling me. Well, we're good guys. They're bad. I almost think it would be better if we had a Democrat governor, because then if the bills that are being put forward, really the only ones we're fighting right now, when I went to the hearing on the school choice, it was a Democrat who was asking the best questions, putting up the best.
I think you are right. I really think you're right, because my governor, you know, I've got a Republican governor. We've got a Republican everything at this point, and we can't do anything. But what I think's happened is that, you know, after the 60s debacle of, you know, the Communist Party in America, and they thought, and if you notice, by the way, we have a new Communist Party standing up that's not afraid to walk through the cities with a hammer and sickle sign that just happened. I mean, you know, that kind of went away. They became the Democratic Socialists of America, and they tried to kind of go underground because the word communist wasn't nice. So they decided to become socialist, this Democratic Socialist. Right. And then it was something else and something else. They always kind of change their names. And I think what's happened here is that they've realized they can't elect any. Look at what they've done. They're destroying their own party with Biden. You can't tell me that's not by accident, or not there's by accident. So whatever's happening, even before all that, they've started moving people into positions that they are labeled as Republican.
Yep.
And they're one of them. Whoever, yeah. You know, they're Democrats that have, you know, hung out. Look at Nikki Haley. Who's her biggest donor? It's a Democrat.
I know.
And I think she's a Soros money person. I can't remember for sure. But
well, Americans for Prosperity are like campaigning for her. And Americans for Prosperity were there the same day that we were there fighting against school choice. They were campaigning for school choice. And they had all these paid assets, like Corey DeAngelis, who was like a, you know, UNESCO poster boy. So I mean, they under the umbrella of being conservative, but
it's anything but real school choice.
Right.
So they change the names. They make the names of the bills sound like something they aren't. They changed. They tried changing their names to kind of give them better imprimatur. And when that didn't work, they put their own people in by just getting them from way back. This is deep thinking. They get people to be part of the Democrat party, that they actually get them to be Republicans early on and let them go to the meetings and let them, you know, come up through the ground as if they're real conservatives. And I'm not saying the Republican Party, but it used to mean something kind of fiscally. It used to have a little bit better record than the Democrats. It's just getting against a tyranny slower. I admit that it's the same. They don't still understand the principles, but in the show that we're watching, now the show is changing its way of putting in the players. So they're just putting their players in every side overtly now. I mean, look, and here's another one. I know that people are not going to like me saying this maybe, but who's the person that lost to governor in Arizona? You know what I'm talking about. Cute gal. She's Carrie Lake. Thank you. Carrie Lake, what did she do before she was running for a Republican office? You know, she was actually a door knocker for Obama for 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't tell me that she is. So again, they're putting their people in here. DeSantis with Harvard, Yale, and DNI in the Navy and various things. So, they all kind of come the same path. They have kind of the same Vivek Ramaswamy again, Harvard, Yale.
Yep.
You know, pharmaceutical. You know, big pharma.
Yep. Yeah. Right. He had that drug that failed and then he made a fortune.
People forget that. People forget that. And I didn't forget that. Because I was a pretty serious, conservative Republican in days past, thinking it was a better choice and we should do so. But I didn't go knocking on doors for people. Mm-hmm. I always voted. I always gave money, but I didn't go knock. It takes something to be that next step of being the person that's out there giving out leaflets and walking.
Totally. Yeah. And most of them are paid. They're funded assets.
That's a good point too.
Not all. There are, I did, I'm embarrassed to say, but I did for Romney.
Now I'm embarrassed to even say I voted for him, but at the time he seemed like a better,
better choice.
It really is the devil you know and the devil you don't know.
Right. Yeah.
It's all been a show for so long. It's been a show for a very long time and we just didn't know it.
But the thing
I was just going to say, I campaigned. I found my husband found my old campaign card when I was asked to be the governor candidate for Iowa for the Libertarian Party. Uh-huh. And I forgot about this. So there was, I had my picture on it and it was all red, white, and blue, but it had, you know, my name for Libertarian, you know, Governor Iowa. And my motto was, because you can't afford the other guys.
I love that.
I was going to say, was I right or was I right?
You were definitely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, for sure. That's
We're in the Truman Show.
We totally are. But I think ultimately that was kind of the big takeaway is that not just through education, but the goal of the education is to create mindless obedient soldiers and to put them in a world federation. That's now it's global citizen. That's the term they're using. And it's really to computerize them. It's to create this transhuman agenda. And that's what this book is all about. You know, they're doing it through SEL and the tech ed. But I think it might be useful just to hear the goals of the Illuminati, because that seems to be what they're carrying out. So you have read this book. And this one does have the five goals listed out pretty succinctly. But this one, he puts in his own little flavor on it, so I can read that to you. And it's he combines it with the Weisshoft, Clinton Roosevelt, and the John D. Rockefeller paper. So he says, it's five goals. It's to overthrow the existing governments and their replacement by a dictatorship of the conspirators, looting individuals and nations of their wealth through such devices as violence and war, capital and income taxes, confiscatory inheritance taxes, and eventually an end to private ownership of property, except at the hands of the conspirators, who will then own all property and usurp the power that such ownership would yield. And so this is tied to the whole land grab agenda. And, my whole theory is that they're then going to price people out of being able to pay taxes, which are already, you're leasing your property. You don't own it. You lease it from the government.
But I think
they're going to price people out where they end up defaulting. The government's going to, that's my theory. But apparently that's what they did in the Roman Empire. And that was part of how they decimated the Roman Empire. So I don't know why they wouldn't use the same playbook. Destruction of all religions, supplanting them with doctrines laid down by the conspirators. Destruction of the family and supplanting its discipline by that of the dictators. Internationalism that was required by the conspirators' scheme for controlling over one world, involving the outlawing of patriotism and the fostering of treason. So, I think that's kind of what we're witnessing today. Yeah, so that has it written in there, but it's this was a little bit more, drawn out, but yeah. But that's, I think, what we're seeing with all of the secret societies. Absolutely. That's what they're doing. So
absolutely. So it makes you wonder now, when you look at the looting. So actually, and I heard a guy I should find this and give it to you. That's on Telegram. It's a 5-minute video. And the guy's just talking about, if you want to know what this is all about, notice all the financial aspect of this. He says it's all about money, and it's not about money for money's sake. It's about owning the resources of the world.
Yeah. Yes.
So let's just look to see who's done that to us. And so that's my point, is that if you want to find out who the members are of the Illuminati and who we're really talking about here, what you have to do is you have to look at over the world's history, and especially over our modern history. Who is it that's looting our country? Who are the people that set up the Federal Reserve? Where's our money being gone? I mean, there's a real simple answer there. It's not everybody. The people that run the Federal Reserve are a very tight group. People that run all the banks are a very tight group. We have to start looking at the people that are doing this to us, because it's a family thing.
Yeah, I think it is a family thing.
Did you notice that Jacob Rothschild now is deceased, apparently?
Yeah, I saw that.
And here's an interesting point about it. There's another thing that showed up. These two guys, I don't know how they found, they went over and they looked at his mansion. Now, they say that he just, I'm sure they're saying he died of natural causes. I haven't heard those story, but there's a meme. I don't learn things by reading stuff anymore. No, I do. But I learn things by memes. And it's a picture of the Grim Reaper. And he's playing one of those, what do you call that thing where you put the quarter in and there's like a big hook in the center and you try and steer it around so it grabs the teddy bear that you want that's down there. It's like a carnival game. Well, anyway. Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to show me the carnival game, but anyway, we have this meme and it's the Grim Reaper and he's playing this carnival game. He's playing this arcade game. I mean, so that he's trying to he's trying to move this little crane around. He's going, oh, come on, George Soros. And then boom, there's this body hanging from the hook. And he says, whoa. I got Jacob Rothschild. Like, he got even a bigger fish,
a bigger prize.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. But anyway, these two guys went through his. They walked and found one of his mansions, one of the Rothschild mansions.
This is the video that you had sent me, right?
No, huh?
Oh, okay.
No, this is totally unrelated. This is just these two guys went out. Two guys, and it's a 6-part thing. Maybe I don't think I sent it to you. This would have been today. Okay. I've been going. 6-part thing, a little short, like TikTok videos. And they have found this mansion that was a Rothschild mansion. It's just like been abandoned. It's got, they're beautiful paintings. Like, they showed a picture that looks like Charles I. It's one of these wall sized antique oil paintings of Charles I. That's not cheap. I mean, and all these other beautiful oil paintings, oriental carpets, chandelier, beautiful things just left there. Stuff that looks like it's just been, very hastily tried to shut down. There's somebody still maintaining the ground, but they're not. Right. But there's, that's not it. This one didn't have a moat around it, but looks like somebody should have had a moat. But yeah,
I mean,
it's a small club that's behind this. But it looks like maybe there's something happening. The other thing is, did you see Kate Middleton is suddenly missing?
Really?
How do you miss the Duchess of whatever, Cornwall or whatever they become?
Yeah. Wow, no, I didn't see that.
Yeah, and they say, well, she's in the hospital or she's blah, 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 but we'll see.
That's very interesting.
They're not showing up anymore. So
yeah, I think it is a very small club, but the problem is that we have the system. I mean, now that I was, really championing this idea of local action. And now that I've been involved in some of the local activities, you see how they've been played by this game, this whole, false dialectic.
Let me ask you, what do you think of the farmer revolt? Again, is that, I every time I think of what you say, every time I see those guys, yes, that looks to me like now it's taken over a meaning that maybe it wasn't intended for, but I think, it sure looks good. I mean,
looks good, but.
But what's the but here?
The but is that they're so far along. It's great that they're standing up, but it's a little bit, they're late. What I really hope happens as a result of them standing up is that people here really pay attention. But when I try and show them what's going on over there, and I'm telling them that the policies that they're implementing here are a gateway to allow that to happen, where they're forced acting. They're forcing them to revolt because that's their it's life or death. That's the
last ditch.
It's their last ditch. And I'm trying to tell them, they say, oh no, I mean, I'm in Tennessee. They're like, we're a red state. You don't have to worry. And I would never let that happen. And I'm like, really? First of all, you don't even see five steps ahead, let alone 20, to see how you're literally creating the blueprint to allow this agenda to move forward. I mean, one of the bills, and I actually confronted him, it was the foresting bill. And I said, oh, that needs to be stopped. And he said, well, I wrote that. And I said, oh, well, I'm sorry. That needs to be stopped.
I'm sorry you were that stupid. Huh? No.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, I'm sorry, but I oppose it. And he said, well, you know, the problem is that there's this conservation bill and people seem to be intertwining them. They're not related. And I said, no, but they're both bad. They both need to be nipped in the bud. And he said, why? And I said, because you're essentially creating green police. That's the UN's goal. And you're basically handing it to them. You're creating it.
I'm sorry, I missed the punchline.
So this is a foresting bill. That's a part of this bill is about, penalize people for just like vandalism, essentially, but in the national parks. And I get that, you know, that we already have laws against vandalism, by the way.
About desecration of things?
Yeah, but what they want to do is create a police force specifically designated to this. And I said, it's under the conservation and, green. And I'm like, you're essentially creating green police. That's what you're doing. And he said,
"You already have
armed
rangers in the parks.
Have that, yes. Yeah. But no, this is very specifically for if you violate or you cause any kind of damage or potential harm to what they call conservation. Now, that doesn't just mean it opens a big can of worms because it doesn't just necessarily mean like outright vandalism. I mean, what constitutes conservation?" For them, it's like, oh, well, if, you know, biodiversity is somehow altered, then you have,
step on that endangered snail.
Right, exactly.
Now, is this limited to the national parks or the state parks?
This is state parks. So they're trying to
impose. Are any other states doing this?
I don't know. I mean, but what I do know is the UN has a plan for green police. I bet they are. I mean, that's my guess. And that's my guess. I haven't dug in enough to know.
And if they did, so this is my point. This is how this is what I'm telling you. We have to get to the looters. And that's in the big category, not just the money looters, but the people taking us down. If we can show, for example, that bill, in one other, a few word differently, is also going through in Wyoming or Utah or Idaho, okay? Then what does it tell you about this guy that wrote the bill? He didn't just spontaneously come up with it.
No, he's carrying the belief anyway. I mean,
probably not, but he didn't. But if he spontaneously came up with it along with five other people in government that spontaneously come up with the same bill, this is my point about looking, about tying things together and saying, this is not a bill that you just came up with. You're working an operation against us.
Yes. And this is the UN. Ensuring environmental sustainability is the seventh millennium development goal. Department of Peace Operations, Department of Field Support are working toward these goals and wish to lead by example in countries which we operate. Yeah. Greening the blue helmet. They want to create green police. So when I saw this bill, and I don't know if it's another state, but I knew about the United Nations police and I knew that they were trying to create green police. So it's like, you are literally laying the groundwork so that you can have locally. And I said, no, I object to it. I don't really care. You know, if you were just, he told me, he said, well, you're welcome to redline it. And I said, great. I'll put an X through the whole thing.
Yeah, a big red line straight down the whole thing. You know?
Yeah. Two red lines, one like that and the other one like that. Yeah. I'm like, I reject the whole thing. I mean, that this is the game they play, that it's, oh, well, the verbiage, it's the, you know, you haven't seen the whole wording, or, well, you can just change some words. It's so easy to amend that. Once it's in, you know, once they take some power and once they have any control, they're just going to keep rolling further. They're not going to yield that. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I have to look. I will actually see if I can find any other state. I'm going to bet on Georgia.
Yeah, that's a good bet.
Things. I'm going to bet on Georgia and maybe Arizona at this point.
Yeah, that might be a good one.
Maybe even Iowa. I'm going to look into Iowa. I'm going to look at the usual suspects. So I'm going to look at some states and see. So I'll get the exact name of the bill from you, but it's going to go by other names in other states.
It's the principle. And the same thing with these vouchers, school choice, that needs to be stopped everywhere. So in some states, when you are homeschooled, you actually opt out of the system. You are really a homeschooler. That is not the case in Tennessee. In Tennessee, you have three categories of homeschooling. One is where it's basically an online homeschooling. So that's obviously not really independent because you've already got a curriculum that's designed for you and it's already under, you know, very specific regulations and that you have to comply with. So that's obviously not really homeschooling, not independent. Then they have what they call independent homeschooling. And that is not very independent at all because they have to submit and take, you know, standardized testing that the government has required, and they have to comply with all sorts of like wellness checks and medical, you know, the vaccine schedule, all of that. So they're not really homeschooled either. And they are indoctrinated because even if the parents have a curriculum that's designed outside, they still have to pass these tests. So obviously you have to teach to pass the test. So they're being indoctrinated whether they want to or not. And then they have what's called category four, which are the religious homeschooling or private schooling. And those have the most freedom. However, they are not completely independent either because they're under these umbrella schools. So the umbrella schools are organizations and they have public-private partnerships. And so they have regulations and then the homeschoolers under them have to comply with that. But what they want, because they do have some freedom, they have more freedom, what they're trying to do in Tennessee, and this is happening across the board. I've seen this in other states where they start doing, it sounds so enticing. Oh, we're giving you choice. We're giving you money. So they'll do these, you know, savings accounts, these vouchers, and the parents think, oh, great, I'm getting $7,000, $12,000, whatever the dollar amount is that they're trying to dangle in front of them. And then they think that there's going to be no strings attached, which I don't know when you've ever seen government money that didn't have strings attached. But somehow, this is going to be the exception. But not only are they going to give them the money, they're going to put it into a digital savings account. So now they're tracking everything. Right. And of course, it's not like you are just going to have a carte blanche, you know, account. Oh, great. I've got $7,000 a year. I think it's $12,000 actually, but whatever the number is, you know, it's somewhere around there, which could help a lot of families, of course. You know, some families that could be, you know, a huge lifestyle difference. However, do they think that they're just going to be able to spend that wherever they want? No, it's going to be in a digital savings account, and there are going to be very specific vendors, and those vendors have already been laid out. They're already talking about transportation. They're talking about uniform. There's specific public-private partnerships that are being set up, and I think this whole thing is just designed to put people into this global surveillance system, so they ultimately will be under, you know, the social credit digital currency, but they want to capture the children because they have a data mining. Right. So now they can create all this data mining. And then through that data mining, they can then control them through the, you know, the research then gets funneled into how they teach them and program them. So
I applaud you going and working on these bills. On the other hand, I will say this. The secret is going to be the fact that we are all many and they are few, which is my point is who's doing to this? Who's that money going to that we're coming out of our taxes going to the Federal Reserve? It's not very many people relative to the rest of us. We are all the big taxed ease. So if we all just say no, if we ask, did you see what happened with Maricopa County the other day? That they got served an affidavit, and I just read about it. They got served an affidavit. Apparently, they walked out or they fled the room because they didn't sign oaths of office. They're not really. They don't have the authority of the people, okay? And so that's why you've been hearing about them setting up apparently a separate state government because this state government's illegitimate. Well, if that, where else is that true? In other words, these are regulations. They're not laws. And even if they pass certain laws, can you pass, this came up the other day with friends of mine. We were talking about their homeowner association. That you can't have you can't do certain things with your property. You can't have chickens. You can't have this and that and the other thing. You can't have your, my town says you can't have my grass more than 11 and a half inches tall. Really? Is that enforceable? And by the way, that's my property rights. That is defined in the Constitution. Okay. Show me your authority to legislate that at any level. Right. That's the, what we, I think this is where we have to go. We have to start realizing for every Skull and Bonesman, to bring it back to our subject, there are a million of us.
Yes.
I mean, that's really, it's a significant advantage. And they are, I think they're running scared because they know that we're waking up to this, which is why they're trying to kill us. But the, but the problem is that, you know, and so that was my point to my friends in the homeowners association. They said, well, when we bought the house, though, it said we couldn't do that. I said, okay, but let's just take it one step back. You're agreeing to their regulation that you think they have the authority to do. Does anybody have the authority to vote away people's property rights?
No.
Well, and if, let's put it in other terms. If the homeowners association said, you can live here, but you have to sacrifice your firstborn male child.
Right.
Could they do that? Of course they couldn't, because that's a basic human right, but so is property rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, property rights is what secures our freedom. And so I think this is where it's got to go.
I think so too. And, you know, it's interesting when you think about like the colonial times, the only people who could vote were property owners, and because they paid property taxes. So property taxes back then were very different. It was almost like being part of a co-op. You know, like if you're a part of a co-op building, you own part of your building, but it's really a shared ownership. And then you have a board, you vote on things. I'm not a huge fan of co-op for that reason. But that's kind of a similar principle, where that's not true today. I mean, everybody votes. No, there's no, you know, there's no barrier of entry. And so the property taxes are really just so the government leases you your property. So you don't really own it. And therefore, we don't really have self-governance either. And that's the thing. So speaking of the Skull and Bones or whatever secret societies there are, or even not just the secret societies, that's just one arm of how they, you know, execute and lever of power over us is through them. But you know, I mean, there are many. It's very intricate web, as you said with your chart. You know, it's a very intricate web. But I think the problem is that because the system is still under this political structure, and they have bribed and co-opted and brainwashed so many of our political officials. I mean, they're really, some of them are corrupt. I mean, some of them have clearly been bribed or blackmailed. And, you know, I don't dispute that that's going on. Some of them are really just brainwashed. And useful idiots, right?
That's right. Those are the useful idiots. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a problem. That's a big, mountain to climb to be able to navigate that and for us to actually have some power, because those are the people who are pushing these things through that are stripping us of all of our rights.
Oh, absolutely. When I get my poster, I'll see where the Skull and Bones fits on.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to look up what 322 means. We did. That was a year.
We did. Yeah. The democracy became a plutocracy.
Very interesting. Yeah. And that's what they're, so these elitists that their kids are in these secret societies, whatever, it's not just the Skull and Bones. We're just using that as an example. Sure. But what they're doing is they're being trained how to deal with each other. So when they get out in secret, they will also deal with each other. So they can then control their little area of the government to deal with us. That's what's happening here, I think.
Yes, I think so too. And I mean, I think the same goes for, you know, any of them, whether it be, you know, the Bohemian Grove, the other sister organizations. There's so many of them, you know, but I think that's how they operate. And
well, I'm reading a really interesting book. It's called The Gods, plural, The Gods of the Bible. Have you heard of this?
No.
The guy who wrote it, Mario Biglioni, I think, something like that. I can't remember. I should know his name. I apologize to him right now. But anyway, he was a Vatican translator of the Bible. And I think, I mean, I don't know if I think he's Jewish. I'm not sure what he is. I don't know that he's Catholic, but he's a Hebrew scholar anyway.
Oh.
And he's also a scholar of other languages. I mean, this book is really interesting because I have to say, I never was comfortable with the Old Testament's morality. I know it's, I mean, the Ten Commandments may be good, but if you look at a lot of what happens there, you've got gods running around murdering people. God, you know, and actually that is the point. The gods of the Bible, moral biglino, that's it.
Well, I thought that was like a lot of the lessons of the Old Testament. It's kind of like people, they turn away from God and then they get punished. And then
what he's pointing out is that it's a translation problem. But the point I'm going to say is that if this is true, what he's saying in the translation, then what we have been conditioned to believe in religion is that is based on kind of a false history, and that the Old Testament is really a trust document between these, whether we want to call them Anunnaki aliens, but they were the El, whatever. This is what Cliff High talks about. They mistranslate the term Elohim as God, but really when he does it very well, because it's not just about that word. That word can be either one, apparently, but it's either, there's all these other parts of speech, the articles and the verbs that surround it, that prove over and over that they're talking about plural group of people.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that before.
Yeah, you know, the point. And so the point is, when you have one of the things that the L did was set up a pyramidal structure of control on this planet with these with the people, the various, you know, to make sure that they had names of them. And some of these names that we attribute to they're historical titles, but we think of them as proper names, but they really were a title of like the chiefdom, how everything is structured under the L so they could control various areas of the world, you know, taking the free form tribal system and making a control system under these various oligarchs, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right. It's very interesting. Now, I mean, that's not a fair, It doesn't eliminate God. It just says what we're reading about in most of that book is not what most people think of their creator God. It is this group of these psychopathic leaders that are running around doing some weird things. And he shows you when it's translated correctly. And we were talking about how one of the things they've done is corrupt religion. Mm-hmm. This is how they've done it, I think. I mean, they've changed it slowly over time so that what the wording is means something different, and people try to accommodate it and make it into a better story, but really this is what it's saying. It's a really interesting book. I'm highlighting it. Maybe I'll have to do maybe I'll get brave and come and bring it on sometime. But it actually would, to me, it's comforting because I think it sorts out the good from the bad.
Okay.
You know, I don't have to believe in some of the things that I was told to have to believe in. And it makes it a lot more understandable, but it also takes what we're talking about. If you look at the leaders of today who we're dealing with, it fits these L had very, very weird specific characteristics. And, and it's some of the things that we're seeing come out now in the world. That's just a teaser for another time sometime.
Okay.
But we are going to have the guy with about land. We are going to talk about land, right?
Yes.
That is a good one. Yeah.
Yes.
That's our next
one. He's great. I had a conversation with him and he is wonderful. I don't know if both of them are coming on together, but at least one of the partners is coming on. Yeah.
Awesome. I think a lot of the Old Testament is about redistribution of land, taking it away from some group and giving it to another group.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
Texas. Well, I cite Texas right now.
Texas?
What are they doing? I mean, they're burning all the cattle land.
Oh, yeah.
I say that way because, again, I think it's an operation. I don't think it's an organic.
I do think it's an operation.
Ron Gibson.
And Robert William. Yeah.
Robert William.
Yes. So I don't know if Ron is joining, but Robert William is definitely joining, and Ron might join as well. So.
Good. That'll be awesome.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, good. Well,
Art, I think we covered all the
I think we
roots for today.
Yeah. And we appreciate our sponsors. And if we could put them up again. I think we should.
Yes.
We have Brave TV, and we have, Brave TV, and you can use bravetv.store/dangerous and get a discount. And that one, the rncstore.com dangerous. And I use
forward slash. They are working on the bars. They are. Yes. They're working on the bars, and they say they have a bunch of other new products too. And it's like a whole line geared towards children, which will probably be super yummy for adults too. But yeah.
Nice. Very good.
All right.
Okay, guys. Well, we will see you next week.
Yes. Next week. Okay. Thanks for watching.
Yep. Be dangerous. See you.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.